Semi-crazy, I think that's less than most. My delusions aren't quite up to snuff. I see the news, a rag soiled with lies. It only gets love when somebody's died. See the cars zip past the crosswalks. Watch you hurry, a wander to the sky. Boring job, one that's gonna kill ya. Turn on, tune in, drop out.
Welcome, one and all, to Professor Metal's Irate Debate and Calamitous Commentary with the Philosophical Chain Gang. Today's episode, Art and Subsidization. Who is paying the piper? I'm your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Sean.
I'm River.
And I'm Bruce. Professor, I'm seeing a lot of painted white faces around the lab lately. What's going on?
I've decided to become a patron of the arts. I'm recruiting mimes.
Why mimes?
To train them to be elite assassins, of course.
But again, why mimes?
Because you'll never hear them coming.
Alright, so art and subsidization. So art is in some ways self-explanatory, and to actually explain art might take a little longer than we have here as a whole. What do we mean by subsidizing art? Like, what are we talking about in that?
How does it get paid for? I think it's fair to say that the economics of art tends to deviate from the economics of most products that we see, at least most of the time. There is some art that the economics of it is very, you go to a bookstore, you know, you maybe buy some books, pop music, some things like that. But there's a lot that goes on in the art world historically, and which still persists, in which art tends to be paid for in a different way than most consumer products.
That's absolutely true. Consumable art is a thing that exists in some sense. We see poster places and other print shops that can provide you with some selection of art options. We also see people picking up various kinds of art in the form of t-shirts and other places like that. But we don't see a lot of the big art, the world-changing art, the stuff that's considered classics and kept in museums and so on and so forth coming out of that system. We see a whole lot of what you could almost call a little A art, a simpler art produced in a different kind of way. And historically, absolutely, it's different. The patronage system used to produce art. Art was produced by the wealthy for the populace as a whole. It was not owned in the same way that we think of owning a car or owning my couch. So I think that it's reasonable to think that art today would also have some differences in the way that it's funded.
There are certain organizations that still do something of a form of patronage, like the National Endowment of the Arts and other national and private organizations that provide grants for artists to kind of try and do big A art. But at the same time, we do see a lot of pushing out, a lot of production of this small A art, what some would call pop art or corporate art or things like that.
I hear it often referred to as high art and low art, although I'm not a big fan of those terms as they generally connote some sort of quality.
We have seen, in some cases, a resurgence of art patronage with things like Patreon, a website that is dedicated to kind of bring that back only in a crowdsource kind of way.
And you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/philosophy.
Really, what we're trying to talk about, I think, is not so much how art is paid for, but more what are the implications of how art is paid for. When a corporation pays for a piece of art to, say, go in their lobby, and an artist is funded, is there a push towards a particular viewpoint? Does the value that art provides to us as a culture get skewed by being paid for or manipulated in certain kinds of ways around money?
Well, I think the first quantifiable thing that we can pull out of this entire system is how is there a centralized small group of gatekeepers deciding that the art gets funded, or is it mass funded? In cases of systems like crowdsourced patronage or systems where popular purchase for a small rate, the masses are dictating it. In cases like a wealthy philanthropist pays for a museum exhibit or a corporation pays for, something fancy for people to look at, there are a small number of curators, which is what they're actually called, sort of, gatekeeping and deciding what gets this funding. So, we can first, trying to measure this, we can pull out a quantifiable thing of how centralized or broadened are the decision makers for what gets voted?
Well, I don't know. I think there's some similarities even between mass funded art and privately or small scale funded art, in that the artist kind of, even if it's unwritten, has these set of goals. It's just what they produce from that point. You have, like, on the large scale, things like fan art and art with mass appeal, art that appeals to a lot of people. So more people are willing to kind of pay to see this art continue. And on the smaller scale, you have the artist trying to maybe make art that appeals to those that would hold the purse strings, as it were, of this selected group of individuals. And I think there's definitely a similarity between those two things, and at the same time a difference between that and the sort of old-school Venetian style of art patronage.
Well, I think that we would be hard-pressed to find an artist who would at least want to admit that the decisions made based on how much money this is likely to bring in are the ones that guide the art that they make. Most artists would like to think that they are exempt from that to some degree, or at least that they could be exempt from that if the money were not an issue. They would just do the things that they thought were important. That said, I think that all too often an artist does find themselves in the position of having to make a decision of, is this going to be popular? Is this going to be something that will be well-supported? Or is this likely to be something that, even though I think is important, is not likely to resonate with other people outside of that? We see situations where the people who have gone ahead and produced the thing they thought was important eventually were recognized. Van Gogh is, of course, the classic example of this. You know, someone who died penniless and then was found later and made famous.
Interestingly enough, not that far later either. Like, it was only a matter of years after his death, only a few before he became really famous in both Paris and his native Holland, due to the efforts of a couple of very devout fans after his death.
And it should be mentioned that the notion of the starving artist who is discovered after his death and then becomes world-renowned is the exception rather than the rule. Most artists that we remember as being great through history in any medium were celebrated in their time.
There's definitely something to that. I mean, there's a reason the starving artist or the poor artist is a trope, and that there certainly have been plenty of artists that have not been recognized in their time. But there are also, I mean, even in modern times, you have Picasso and Dali were both well recognized before, or in their lifetime, and became quite wealthy off of it. The recognition was to the point where Picasso would doodle on his checks so that nobody would ever want to cash them, because the worth of the doodle was probably greater than the worth of the check at its written value. Dali certainly was a bit of an art superstar in his time for kind of challenging the system. But even if you go back to Renaissance times, Da Vinci was well known, and he was lauded and highly supported by the Medici family, along with many others, and was definitely recognized. But there are, of course, others that didn't quite get there. Van Gogh, of course, again, the classic example. Some of the Franco-Belgian surrealists didn't quite get there in their time. I mean, Magritte, he was gaining some fame before his death, but he definitely broke out around closer to the end, I think.
Well, and Andy Warhol comes to mind as a counterexample. He was sort of the quintessential artist as celebrity in his time, you know, well-recognized, hobnobbed with the rich and famous because of the art that he did. But that said, I think I'm not qualified to speak to what more or less of the artists we recognize from history were in their time or were not. I'm not enough of an art historian for it. But that said, it seems like the decision-making process that leads one to produce work that is culturally important is at least sometimes driven by the need to fulfill basic requirements, Maslow's hierarchy of needs style. you know, the ability to feed and shelter yourself being more important than your artistic integrity to most people.
It's true, and I think it's kind of weird that there's this sort of pushback, and I suspect it's been around in society for a while, but it's definitely with the internet age and the advent of digital media, there are a lot of people that seem to feel, for their own benefit sometimes, that artists shouldn't necessarily be paid for their work. There's been plenty of photographers who've been approached by large companies to use their work for quote-unquote exposure, to get their name out there. And this is such a problem to a point that there have been Pulitzer Prize-winning artists, photographers, that is, that have been approached by, like, NBC, in a recent example. I can't remember the photographer's name off the top of my head, but was approached by NBC to use some of their work for exposure, even though they won a Pulitzer Prize. They're already recognized in their time for their work. I see this a lot, of course, on the internet, of people being like, well, maybe you should draw this thing because I like your art and I want to see it, but I don't really want to pay you, but I'll share it. You know, that sort of thing. As opposed to paying a commission, which is what would be the nature of small A art, where somebody is being paid directly for the piece of work that they're doing by a single buyer or by a small group of buyers.
In the contemporary world, with such things as, you know, internet viral phenomena and celebrity culture, there is an exchange rate for fame to money. That's definitely true. I think most people who aren't working in a medium where they might actually make money off that can overestimate what that exchange is. I think somebody who is an artist, they realize just how much fame would translate into what dollar figures. They've got some idea of that, what exposure is worth. I think others who would like them to do things think that exposure is perhaps worth more than it is.
Well, let's talk a little about municipally funded art. Art that gets paid for by a governing body of some sort. This seems like an interesting category to me because in some way we are all paying for that art by paying tax dollars into the system. So why do we continue to use a system wherein everybody pays but a small number of people choose what art is produced in that way? What advantages and disadvantages does that system have compared to, say, the commissioning system that you talked about, where a single individual basically goes to an artist and says, I'd like you to make this. And they go, oh, I could make that.
There is some advantage to a small group choosing what art is being paid for with public money, in that they have, I hesitate to say credentials, but they have some idea what they feel would work well for the larger group, the public at large, or at least they would like to think that, or they, you know, they have been invested with this power to choose what they feel is best art for the public at large.
They have some credentials in the business of translating public purpose into an actual physical object. There's that. It isn't an aesthetic judgment, so it is kind of gets murky. One thing I would say is that you would think that through this process, we would get the most conservative artwork, the most, you know, boring, old school, don't rock the boat. And yet, now that I think about it, you know, I think of so many examples, from the original Eiffel Tower to the London Eye to all sorts of these public projects that actually have been very outside the box, you know, that have gone through this process, that aren't conservative at all for their time. They're very dramatic and often very controversial.
I think that it's an easy answer, and one that I think most of us probably default to when thinking about a question like this about municipal art projects, to assume that it's a matter of tastes. That the issue is one of many people's tastes don't line up, so a small group is created to make sure that the art is tasteful to the most possible people. That said, I think that there's another element that we don't think about very often, which is that to some degree, the point of doing municipal art projects is to foster art as a public good. And in that way, you are better off fostering artists who you believe will have the potential to create more good works in your community than you are, say, commissioning a piece of art from somewhere far away. An artist somewhere else, say, you know, for example, someone lives in Paris, but we're commissioning a piece of art for San Diego. If you hire a person from Paris to do that, in some sense, you are sending that money away. You're developing Paris's art scene, as opposed to your local communities. And I think that one of the concerns, one of the advantages of having a committee like that that does monitor and, to some degree, shape the process of municipal art purchases is to develop an artistic community within the place that you're already at. Because then you're likely to produce more good art from it by having supported the artists in that community to begin with.
I definitely agree, and I mean, here in Portland specifically, we have had a long history of trying to do municipal art projects and trying to sort of foster art as a thing Portland does, I guess, with the, I mean, back in the 80s you had the whole Expose Yourself to Art program itself becoming the posters that were generated from that becoming their own sort of meta art piece that helped elect a mayor. Which is just kind of odd, that Portland has kind of become known as this haven for artists and weirdos and malcontents over the years because of it, because the city government has definitely been very big on supporting art and putting art out in the world. I mean, it's hard to go a block without running into a installation of some variety, be it statuary or a fountain or...
A busker.
A busker, certainly. Oh, absolutely.
Murals and the building side art, a lot of that around here.
Mm-hmm. And that has definitely helped grow the grassroots art community. You end up with things like the 24-hour Church of Elvis, which is something that unfortunately no longer exists, but is, by all accounts, like the perfect example of modern pop art.
But that sort of democratized DIY small-scale everywhere art, which, if you've got lots of people doing it, adds up to the equivalent of maybe one big piece, but builds a community, that is also something that's always been with us. If we trace the history of art, let's say, from the just before the beginning of the 19th century onward, everybody had musical instruments in their homes. The first music publishing was sheet music, for people to play music for themselves and each other in their homes. And then came the first turntables, and we started to get a move away from that. But throughout history, probably more so in the past than in the modern age, everyone made art for themselves and one another, and it was a normal thing to do. Now, the big fancy artwork, that was still, yeah, that has still centralized gatekeeping subsidy, but people making art was something that we did for ourselves. Particularly since the point after electric light existed, when people were staying up late and had less to do, and before we had lots of stereophonic recording ability.
So I think that you may be onto something there, at least in terms of the visual arts. There's some research now showing that our sleep schedule hasn't changed as much as people tend to think. As it turns out, even early humans tend to stay up fairly late into the night. It's just that we occupy ourselves with a different kind of art, more of a performance art, storytelling around fires, group singing, dancing, that sort of thing. Community endeavors of one sort or another that one could easily call art or proto-art in a lot of ways. But I think that what I'm trying to get at, what I was trying to ask about, I guess, is the value of art as a public good. When we foster creating an artist community of some sort, the point is to produce more art in that place, right? To have more great art there. But why would you want that? What is the advantage to having great art in a place?
I think, in a way, art is an expression of how people feel about things, either in a direct way with expressionism or impressionism and things like that, or an indirect way with the meta arts and Dadaism and surrealism and stuff like that. And I think having art in an area gives people the drive to express themselves more freely or to be more, for lack of a better term, kind of authentic about what they do. And, I mean, aside from the cultural value that provides, it allows people to be more honest in a way, to express themselves as opposed to just kind of going about things the same way all day, every day, you know, being able to kind of speak their mind, being able to feel like they can speak their mind without repercussion.
It certainly helps with pride of place. I mean, art describes the landmarks of any place. And also, this is maybe a bit of a conjecture I'm just going to throw out. Art, as arbitrary as it may be, for a city or a community to create a lot of art, kind of says, in the same way that a peacock's feathers say, I have the surplus economic capability to create all of this arbitrary beauty, which does not have any practical value, but shows that I can generate this surplus creation, which shows that I'm a healthy, thriving community.
So I think you're going in a really interesting place with that. My initial thought is, you mentioned that art can define the landmarks of a place, but art can also become a landmark in a place. In a lot of cases, the art itself becomes the reason to travel to that place. You can think of the Louvre in Paris. Thousands and thousands of tourists are constantly streaming to the Louvre and to Paris in general because that's where the Louvre is. The place can actually pick up some tourism benefit from that. It's a way to say to the world, we have great works here. Come and be a part of this place that we are creating for this.
Or, you know, just tourism, but if you've got lots of, you know, thriving art going on in a place, that is a quality of life measurement. And that's as people say, hey, upwardly mobile people, you should move here. This is a good place to live. If you can afford to move, you should move here. That is something that Portland is experiencing a lot of right now.
Absolutely. I mean, for better or for worse, the reputation that Portland has gotten for being a place of weirdos and of alt lifestyle, it has certainly attracted a lot of people to the point where there is constant construction going on to house them all.
So part of the value of that tourism, attraction, announcement to the world benefit is definitely to bring in more affluent people, right? To bring more money into the system. If you're someone who's interested in art in general and you are affluent, then you're probably someone who wants to buy art, sell art, possibly be involved with the support of artists, and so you will go to a place where there are a lot of artists to be exposed to. But another benefit that goes out to the people in that place directly touches on what River was talking about self-expression. And that's that art is, in some sense, a way for us to understand ourselves, to understand our own internal states. By looking at and trying to analyze and understand a piece of art, I gain some insight into my own internal thought process, my own feelings, my own attachments to the world. And I know we've mentioned this before, but to talk about Guernica, for example. This is a great example of an instance where there is very little in the art itself. The actual shapes, the colors, it's very minimal, simplistic in some sense. There is a lot going on, but there is not a whole lot of detail for me to examine in the way that there is with, say, like the Mona Lisa, or another classical Renaissance-style work of art, where there's a whole lot of fine detail to talk about in a particular way. Instead, I'm asked to talk about, or perhaps not to talk about, but to consider what I bring to that piece, what the artist was trying to say with that piece, how I interpret that piece, all of the interaction that I have with that, and how it makes me feel, how I think about things, in what ways does this reflect an attitude about the world or events that were going on. It makes me a richer person internally for having had that. And by living in a place where there is a lot of good art to be had, you have more opportunities to have a rich and fulfilling inner life in that way, which means that the populace of a place like that is, in general, a happier populace overall.
Even for pieces of art which I can't necessarily get a handle on, which seem very kind of weird and alien to me, I really like thinking, I live in a place where somebody made that. It suggests a certain diversity of thought. If I see something that really resonates with me, I get that. If I see something that doesn't, I think, hey, this is a very diversely creative place.
So let's talk a little bit about the effect that that can have when that process is used differently. Say, corporate art or art that has some kind of message controlled by someone outside of the sphere of the public good. when someone is not making decisions based on what's best for the public, but instead what's best for them personally or their company, how does that affect the process?
The term corporate art is, at least to me, and I suspect to others, very much tied to pieces of art in any media that is not as, I guess, vibrant. You have, of course, the hotel painting that is usually very, sometimes very busy, but sometimes very minimal, but usually saying not much of anything. And as far as, like, music goes, you have Muzak, elevator music, something that sounds similar to something else, or something familiar, but is distinct enough so that they don't have to pay royalties, and kind of background more than anything. Not defining a place, but sort of
or hold complimenting. Music. Hold music. Smooth jazz hold music. I think that's the new corporate music.
So basically what we're describing is something that's sort of like the shadow of art. Something that is a faux art. It is art in a very technical sense, in that it is a creation done by someone in the ways, in the forms of art, but it lacks the depth or further meaning that most art is intended to convey.
It may be pretty or soothing, but it does not make a statement at all.
So why is that less good than the art that we were just describing?
Kind of depends on what you mean by less good. If we're talking about a cultural sense, I think it definitely lacks the sort of cultural impact, or tends to lack a cultural impact in the way that art that is produced out of passion or out of the public good tends to be produced. It is stock, as it were. This painting may be unique, or this piece of music may be unique, but there are so many iterations that are different, but in very many ways the same, that it all kind of blends together and washes out, as it were.
It's unique in the way that snowflakes are unique, but if you look at the snowbank, it doesn't really matter that all the snowflakes are unique. Now, if you had a red snowflake, that would be unique in a different way. I think why this kind of art would seem to have less artistic value is because it is not communicating a point of view, which is an important factor in aesthetic judgment, I think.
So I don't know if corporate art is necessarily any less good inherently, because I think that part of the good in art comes from us viewing it, from the person who goes and actually pays attention to it, analyzes it. And I think you can do that with even something that is created whole cloth without intention. That said, if we want things that are challenging in our artwork, then it seems like corporations are disincentivized from creating challenging art, which means there's a more limited range of possible things that I could gain from the experience of viewing art. Sometimes viewing art that is unpleasant is more valuable than viewing a pleasant piece of art. I'm thinking specifically of the photo Napalm Girl from the Vietnam era. This is a very hard to look at photo, but it also communicates something very important about the nature of war and what our country was involved with at the time. It was taken as a piece of journalism, but has become a piece of art in its own right. I think that corporations are disincentivized from supporting or commissioning art like that, because it does not benefit their bottom line. It does not benefit the purpose of the corporation, which is to make money. So giving people a false happy sensation is more valuable than giving people a very real unhappy sensation.
Well, there's nothing wrong with having something, you know, soothing that doesn't particularly make you angry. And sometimes it's the right time to see something that confronts you and challenges your expectations. One of the difficulties with these kinds of aesthetic judgments of art is that, frankly, it's entirely arbitrary, both economically and in terms of immaterial value. And that's one of the more interesting things when we're talking about the economics of art, is how to subsidize it, is that you can put any number on any piece of artwork and that's what it's considered to be valued at, which, frankly, is further incentive for corporations to buy up quite a bit of it, because it allows them to move numbers around pretty much wherever they want them to be.
Well, let's talk about the flip side of that, then. So if I were to pick a name out of a hat, say, Lysol Company, there is a direct incentive to make you feel icky to sell more Lysol. A world in which you are afraid of germs and bacteria and things that are crawling on every surface makes you want to disinfect it. So wouldn't it be to their advantage to support art that makes you feel icky about the world?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I doubt they would throw down on patronizing somebody like Giger or his contemporaries, but I feel that's probably a different type of icky than what you're referring to. A more visceral sort of disgust than anything. But yeah, I think it would benefit them greatly if they could produce an art that they could put on things. And in some ways you could say that, without getting too much into it, the images used in a commercial for Lysol as a form of corporate art, in that they are produced and they have a structure to them and are produced in ways similar to other art.
It'd generally be a humorous cartoon germ of some sort that we see in these sorts of things.
Well, those are the things we associate with Lysol, but there's really no requirement for a corporation to announce which collectives they supported or through which back channels, which means that, say, I'm an artist and I would like to do a piece in which I show the human body as a teeming cesspool of horrible things, and I'm going to make a series of photographs in which people look disgusting because of things growing on their skin and whatnot. If Lysol comes around the backside and says, you know what, we'd love to give you some money to make that, because we want to push the public consciousness, the zeitgeist, towards a certain view of humanity as disgusting and covered with germs, there's really no way that the public would know about that.
I would like to say that I don't think that marketing people have gotten around to that yet, but I've got a feeling you've got some examples in your back pocket already.
I don't off the top of my head, actually.
Funny enough, I do.
Okay. All right.
So there is something that has been coming about lately called native advertising. Although it's not been used specifically in art, it has been used in faux journalism, basically, online blogs, stuff like that, where a writer will be paid either directly or indirectly by a company, corporation, project of some sort, somebody with a lot of money, to talk about a certain thing. They don't necessarily have to lie about a certain thing or toe the party line. They just are asked to write about a certain thing, to bring it to the forefront of our mind. And most of the time, the publisher of these articles is honest about it, and you'll sometimes see articles in newspapers that say, like, there's an article on women's prison, to use an example, that is sponsored by Orange is the New Black, a comedy show on Netflix ostensibly about that. And it will say that, but sometimes they're not so honest about it. Sometimes it may be in a little corner off to the side that says sponsored content, and sometimes it's not. It'll say maybe sponsored content. Sometimes it won't even have a tag on it at all. It'll just be an article about a thing that is suspiciously similar to this thing that a company wants brought into the public eye. And it isn't that far of a leap to take that to art, to a more artistic media. In a way, product placement is kind of like that in the form of films and movies, where to get the movie paid for, the director or the producer will put strategically placed Coke machines or have the big bad fall into a Macy's or something of that ilk. And that's been something that's been going on for years, for almost as long as we've had recorded film. Sometimes it would be obvious, like Rod Serling taking a break from the Twilight Zone to rep a brand of cigarettes that happened to be sponsoring NBC at that time, a thing which Rod Serling hated, but had to do it to get his show made. More recently, it's a lot more insidious than that. It's just kind of a little thing off in the corner that you don't realize until after you're sitting there drinking a Coke.
The hypothetical that we were concerned about and trying to figure out if it's a reality and if it's not, then we've probably given a bunch of marketing guys the idea, and now it's going to happen, is what if the marketing people get the artists to write about a certain subject that they want brought to the public consciousness, which will help them sell their product. This kind of gets us back into artist propaganda, which we've discussed before, because the best examples I can think of are, for example, propaganda films or patriotic movies at certain times when we're trying to be extra patriotic. Which is another thing. What if politics, they've got lots of money in politics, what if they get into manipulating art?
Well, I think we see that on a fairly regular basis, but we see it in sort of an interesting place. Presidential portraits, statuary, and the like. The image of the leader of the country is a kind of figurehead symbol in which we spend a lot of time very concerned about the representation, and thus what artists do what with it and where it is displayed. The National Gallery has portraiture of almost every president. I think we lost a couple during the fire back in the 1800s. But those portraits are very specifically and carefully chosen artists representing that person. Again, the Treasury. They are in the process of commissioning a great deal of art by way of saying, this thing shall be the representation of our nation's symbol. This will be the eagle we use on this. This will be the mountain that is shown in the background of that item. These are ways in which we already manipulate the symbology of art to give us a particular sense of the place in which we live and the patriotism that should be associated with it.
Well, we've always done that since the very beginning, though.
Sure. Well, I don't think it's anything new. I wasn't trying to argue that we just started doing this. I think that we see that in ways that we are not as aware of as perhaps we would be, say, native advertising like we talked about. Perhaps I'm a little bit cautious when I look at a magazine and I see something that looks like an ad for something but seems to be in the style of the magazine. I might look for that little annotation at the bottom that says, oh, hey, this was paid content by so-and-so. That said, I might not be so careful about, say, something hanging in the National Gallery or at the Smithsonian or even in the post office, for that matter.
I think there has been concern from some parts that some art may have been politicized when they say, you know, these are those people who control the media, they're making movies to try and sway people's minds. One thing about movies in particular as subsidized art is they're almost immune to it, in that if someone were to spend a whole bunch of money on a movie and they were to make less than that amount back, that would be considered a flop and that movie would be considered a failure. Ishtar is a great example. So it's almost impossible to subsidize a movie and then have it be considered a failure. It's entirely, the litmus test of whether a movie succeeded or not is entirely based on how much demand, how much were the ticket sales, that's it. The notion that people could pump money into certain types of movies in order to manipulate the public consciousness, they're almost sort of resistant to that based on the way that we judge movies.
That might be true in terms of movies as a commercial venture or even the American movie audience, but it's not necessarily true in terms of international distributions. In this case, I'm particularly thinking of times when we have subsidized the production of some piece of media like Dr. Zhivago, and hoped that its distribution around the world would then have an influence outside. The CIA directly paid for the production of the book Dr. Zhivago in the hopes that it would get into the Russian market and would thus become something that created an undercurrent of distrust in the Russian government. This is an example of using it in that way, and I think that we could do the same thing with movies like Zero Dark Thirty, for example. Not necessarily a critical success, and to some degree a box office success in terms of American standards of movie as a product, how much money did it make, but later distribution, especially through piracy and other undercurrents that now spread worldwide from the American movie industry, is an opportunity to press something into culture, even if it's not something that does terribly well here and now.
Professor, what's that noise?
Obviously, it's a warning siren.
Okay, but what kind of warning siren?
My God, it's an existential crisis! Everyone into the think tank!
Well, I hope there are snacks this time.
Will the philosophical chain gang prevail against the existential crisis? Will they fall prey to crushing ennui? Who will blink first when the abyss stares back, Find out in the thrilling conclusion of Art and Subsidization, Who's Paying the Piper?
Security, slavery, it's better than the dark. Let's go.